The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance political journalist Marie Leconte.
We are joined by John Elledge. Now, John describes himself as a journalist, commentator, raconteur and geek, which is good because Marie is three of those and I'm one. He's written for The Guardian, The New Statesman and Independent Nurse magazine. And in 2008, he had an Australian dinosaur fetishist ask the internet to pray for his soul.
I think you're probably the only person who's ever read the about page on my WordPress.
Oh, well, right. it's a veritable goldmine.
I've forgotten that existed.
Well, thank you for joining us. You're now editor of New Statesman's City Metric site. Tell us about that.
So, yeah, it's cities, nerd stuff. I mean, the way I describe it is like, you know, it's about the human world, which is really my way of saying that it's meant to be a cities site, but I kind of do whatever I want on there and nobody tells me not to. So we do a load of transport stuff, a load of maps. People love maps, architecture, politics. But also occasionally if someone pitches me a really interesting idea about, I don't know, what meteorites are called, which is not really a cities-based story in any sensible definition, I just kind of think, you know, fair game, really.
Any nurses, independent or otherwise, featuring on your website?
No, not really. It's my health reporting days were a long time ago. Also, it's like the thing about writing about the NHS is if you're out of the sector for about 18 months, they change all the acronyms, so you can't really understand what the hell anyone's talking about anymore. It's the same stuff, but they've relabeled everything.
Is that a deliberate ploy?
I think it probably, yeah, they keep the deck chairs moving just to make sure that like no one can ever judge how a particular set of reforms has gone, because they're not allowed to bed in for long enough to actually kind of, you know, show whether they've worked or not. It's a clever way of getting around that whole accountability problem.
Oh, that's interesting. I see you also went to Brentwood School, which regular listener will know is also the school that previous guest Sophie Jarvis went to. So now we've had two former students from Brentwood School. Next week we're going to have Noel Edmonds on to talk about the TV license. So he's a former student.
You could have Jack Straw, he was one of ours.
I
Andrew
think
we'd
have Jodie Marsh.
Yeah, I'd go with it. Or Frank Lampard. He'd probably be quite fun, actually.
But we're going to start this week with the World Cup and a crisis that has really hit at this time of year. Britain is facing a beer shortage. John, I don't know if you've seen this, but what's described as a chronic shortage of carbon dioxide has hit supplies of beer just at the time when the World Cup is starting to heat up. Beer is being rationed. Companies like Coca-Cola and Heineken have been affected, and it's even now having a knock-on effect to abattoirs, and so meat supply could be affected as well.
How?
I think we might need you to unpack that bit a little
bit. Fizzy animals?
Have you never seen that trick where they stick a... No.
Oh, is this the thing where they use Coca-Cola to kind of mop up bloodstains? Because it's like the only thing that will get them off, like when there's been a really bad road accident. Coke is the only thing that will get the blood off the road. I swear I'm not making this up. This is a real thing.
So what you're saying is...
Subscribe to Polling Politics, where we talk about polling and politics and how to get away with murder.
Exactly. Heard it here first. John has described how to get rid of a lot of bloodstains. No, it's actually, when you think about it, but you'll like this.
Might come up. That's all I'm saying.
Carbon dioxide is used in the stunning of animals. And so if you don't have the carbon dioxide, you don't have the stunning of the animals. You don't have the meat. What do we think? Can Britain go on without beer for a period of time? As someone from foreign climes, Marie, what's your take on this?
Well, surely I feel like you guys can still keep drinking the sort of like, you know, all the ales and the stouts and whatever, all the really weird beers you have that don't have any bubbles in them. So I think really this is actually going to hurt the Europeans who moved to the UK and only like lager because all the English beers are awful. So once again, Brexit, you know, is proving to be a hostile environment for EU citizens in the UK.
Well, apparently the low supplies of carbon dioxide were caused by maintenance to the CO2 plants and specifically not Brexit. So unusually this is something that hasn't been blamed
for. It is going to be quite Brexit if like the only beer available is the kind of lukewarm ale stuff that all tastes the same that people pretend is like tastes very, very different. I once went to a real ale thing where someone gave me a pint of real ale.
Campaign for real ale?
No, it was just being catered by them. It was like some random music event, I think. But like all they had on site was real ale. And someone gave me a pint of it and said, there you go, you won't go back now. And it's like, I bloody will, you know. I've tasted it, you're not fooling me.
I won't go back home.
But that would be quite Brexit if like literally the only beer available was that kind of stuff that you have to pretend is
it's
nice.
Just mead. From now on, it's just mead and other medieval drinks.
What's the cider situation?
Well, presumably cider would be affected as well, but there haven't specifically been reports about that. I think we can only pray that that the very fabric of society does not break down if this rationing continues. But when my grandma now talks about the difficulties she faced with rationing, I can respond and say, but, you know, was it during a World Cup? And speaking of having to make do with things, the Supreme Court this week has ruled that heterosexual couples can be civil partnered. Is civil partnered even the term?
Can I just say the quality of the segues on this podcast is really something else. Right.
Thank you. I am taking this at face value and saying thank you very much, John Ellidge.
Yeah, I sense no sarcasm in your comments at all.
Speaking of nouns... Like,
that's a good one, write it down.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what are they doing words? civil partners. John, do you believe that we should all be able to get civil partnered and married? Or should we just all get married, just all get civil partnered? How do you think it should work?
I kind of think there's an obvious, of a logical way of sorting this out, which is you kind of split the legalistic bit from the kind of, you know, religious or ceremonial bit. So, like, it is kind of weird that, like, registry office weddings are somehow different from civil partnerships. It kind of feels like it's the same. It's the state's recognition of a relationship without a religious element, right? But the problem with this argument is you've then got, you know, all of human history kind of working against it, where, like, you know, marriage is kind of a sort of religious ceremonial thing. So it's probably not going to happen. But yeah, I don't see any reason why. I mean, since we now have gay marriages, which is obviously, you know, we should have, it doesn't make any sense to me that, like, we have this whole other thing that is only open to same-sex couples. It just seems like, you know, level the playing field seems a sensible thing, really.
Marie, you've got your I just don't care dress on. How do you feel about this?
Well, Joe, I don't care. But no, I mean, generally, I have, you know, very few sort of like strong opinions about this. I'm just using more words to say I don't care. Like, generally, like, I can't even, and I have an opinion about many, many things. You know, I can make up an opinion on the spot about a lot of stuff. Just nothing. I have nothing to say.
So what you're saying is you just don't care about the rights of straight couples. Is that
exactly.
What you're saying?
No. Right. I think that, you know, I will not get married until, you know, only gay couples can get married. Stop the straights from getting married. That's my point. There you go. That's my opinion.
This is reminding me of there's an amazing Onion story out there about, like, a guy who's been refusing to get married on principle because gay people can't, is now getting increasingly nervous.
Carrying on the quality segues and thinking about awkward partnerships between people who perhaps should not be together. The cabinet. we've had a week of real craziness, even by the standards of the, in inverted commas, collective responsibility governing Theresa May's cabinet. We've had Gavin Williamson kicking off over funding for the armed forces. We've had Greg Clark attacking Boris and Jeremy Hunt. We've had David Davis being David Davis. We've had Boris, of course, and we'll come back to that later. And we had Liz Truss at the LSE. I don't know if you had the pleasure of hearing her joke about wood-burning goves.
Eating too many donuts or enjoying the warm glow of our wood-burning goves. Sorry, I mean stoves. And I can see their point. There is a lot of hot air that does emerge from the department.
Theresa May, has she lost control of her cabinet?
I question the premise of the question because that does rather assume that she ever had it in the first place. It is kind of barking the number of ministers that are just have done things that in normal times would have meant they would be sacked. Like Boris Johnson managed to endanger the freedom of a British citizen abroad, which is not a great look from Britain's chief diplomat. David Davis, like, basically cheerfully admitted he'd lied to Parliament. Liam Fox is Liam Fox. You know, this has been going on for quite a while. That it's like,
I don't think you can sack Liam Fox just for being Liam Fox.
It's more that, like, he should clearly never have been. I mean, like, there is an official There is an official report from the head of the civil service that said Liam Fox was a security risk. Genuinely. So he should probably have not been allowed back into the cabinet in the first place. There's just, you know, in normal times, like Theresa May's election result would have, like, pushed her out. There's just, we're kind of so far past the point where, like, you know, just a bit of freelancing, that's fine. Like, Gavin Williamson is just, he's sticking up for his department. That's kind of his job. Like, since collective cabinet responsibility has been dead for well over a year now, I really don't think that's that bad under the circumstances. I think it's just being sort of talked up because, partly because it's like, it's the first in what's probably going to be a barrage of these obvious responses to the NHS thing, which is like, okay, everyone's going to ask for money now. But also because there is this, Gavin Williamson has this quality that makes you want to mock him. So I think like him doing something slightly stupid did kind of inspire people to kind of lay in. But I actually don't think in terms of the habits of this current cabinet, I really don't think this is that big a deal.
I'd say that actually the Gavin Williamson thing, what was different is the fact that, you know, he was not a Mayite, you know, pre-May, and very much kind of jumped on that bandwagon because you know, he's very good at sort of like internal Tory stuff. And then, you know, got very, very quickly to like become a sort of like senior cabinet minister, thanks to May. But then I think has that thing where he's been quite open, I think, you know, behind closed doors, talking to people, basically saying, you know, as I think was the Sunday Times story of, you know, I made her, I can destroy her, like, and bring her back down or whatever. But which is something he has said to several people, you know, I've been hearing rumours about that for a while. And I think for the Tories, it's a case of like, come on, like, you were never meant to get a job this good. You got it because of that woman. Like, maybe you didn't spend your entire time rubbishing her. So I think that's kind of where the Williamson thing came, is like, yeah, Jesus Christ, like, just behave.
My favourite thing about Gavin Williamson is that when all the when there was all the furore about the affair that he had, the woman at the fireplace selling place, the report in the Daily Mail took the trouble of specifying that he no longer sells fireplaces.
Okay, so my favourite thing about this story, like, literally, tinfoil hat on, the fact that he admitted he was at, we snogged twice on, you know, like, a trip away from home. I refuse to believe, like, I feel like, you know, two adults can probably, like, snog once, and then you probably end, like, it's a weird thing. You don't have an affair that consists of snogging twice. That's not a thing. There you go. Listen to my other podcast.
Yeah, and join us next week for when Marie lists a number of other things that you can only do twice. Is Theresa May capable of improving the situation, or are we now stuck?
I can only see two ways. Well, no, hang on, three. I can see three ways that she could regain her authority. One would be an election that goes better than the last one. I don't think that's likely for a variety of reasons. Another would be somehow managing to sort out the Brexit mess. I also don't think that's likely for a different variety of reasons. The third would be a war. If we have a war, that might do it.
Who should we have a war with?
Shotgun, not the French.
Who is most likely to knock us out of the World Cup?
Brazil, perhaps?
Belgium?
Belgium can't knock us out because we've won our first two games, Marie. That's what happens when your first two games.
I know, but hang on, Spain, what happened? You know, what happened to war with Spain?
Oh, that was a brilliant week.
It was. I'm bringing back. I'm saying war with Spain.
So war with Spain, you think, is the most likely way that she can salvage?
I think a war with Spain would bring the country together. I think it's probably not a great idea. I would like to make
You're
it
not
clear.
Advocating it.
I am not. Yeah, I would like to make it absolutely clear. I am not in favour of war with Spain.
Well, don't nod your head like that.
I really don't know where to go with this. You told me that this was going to be about Heathrow and Brexit. I didn't know I was going to have to, like,
I didn't know I was going to defend my stance.
I was going to be responsible for a major international incident.
Oh, yeah, well, that's what, like, they all say.
God, can you imagine if we actually end up going to war with Spain and people will point it back in, like, years and years, being like, you know, in that one podcast, you know, that went on to, you know, earn millions of pounds in all the awards.
So Ladbrokes Politics, who kindly sponsor this show, they have Chris Grayling as the most likely person to leave the cabinet next. You've done a lot on transport. Is Chris Grayling a dead man walking? And he's having to walk because his train's been cancelled.
I'm going to undermine my entire position speaking out loud here, but don't ask me for predictions. I'm bloody rubbish at them. Like, every time I predict anything, literally the opposite happens 5 minutes later. So,
and do you think that'll happen this time?
On that basis alone, I'm not the one to ask. But my instinct is that I just don't see why they push him out over this. because...
Is it more convenient for him to absorb all the...
Yeah, that's my thinking. Like, okay, to be fair, like, Chris Grayling is a man who, like, everything he touches turns to crap. Like, he has been screwing up repeatedly in every role he has had since he was, what was he, Shadow Home Secretary back in the last years of the Brown government. And he first kind of hit the headlines. Firstly, he said that Manchester had the same kind of level of gun crime as the Baltimore featured in The Wire. Secondly, which went down very well, obviously.
Secondly, he then admitted to having never seen The Wire, knowing where Baltimore was, and not knowing where Manchester was.
He also like caused a bit of a furore when he suggested that, you know, bed and breakfast should be allowed to turn away gay couples on principle. So, like, this kind of lost him his cabinet job. When the coalition happened, he ended up as a relatively lowly minister. And I think that's probably because it had already become clear that he was a bit of a liability. But this has continued. Everything, like he single-handedly rehabilitated Michael Gove by just enabling Gove's tenure at Justice was basically undoing everything Grayling had done. And Gove is now remarkably popular with the legal industry. The transport stuff, the problem is actually, it's not really his fault. Like, there are many, many problems with the British rail system as currently constituted, but the mess on the Thames Link network in the south and the mess in the Northern Rail network in the north, neither of these are things which Grayling has caused. He has screwed up the way he's handled them, but the problems do not magically go away if he's fired. So some other minister just ends up becoming the hate figure. So really, they might as well leave him in post.
And so if transport is going to be an ongoing disaster area for the next however many years, you may as well have him in post and accepting all the slings and arrows.
Yeah, why wreck someone else's reputation when, like, Grayling can just kind of absorb this stuff?
But again, isn't the thing as well that the bar is now so high in terms of what you have to do to sort of, like, get sacked in the cabinet? Why, I feel like it's not something you can start, because if one person has to go, then there will be questions about, okay, well, fine, Grayling had to go because of X, but then why didn't Boris go because of that, and why didn't X and Y and whatever? So I think that she can't sack anyone because she'd basically have to sack half of them for it to make sense.
Supporting Brexit is a shield, like, because Grayling was a very prominent Brexiteer. That kind of gives him a sort of safety barrier, I think. I think the only resignation that doesn't fit that pattern was Priti Patel, who was a Brexiteer and was forced to resign. But I think, generally speaking, those who campaign for Remain have gone, and those who campaign for Leave have stayed, however badly they've screwed up.
And also, Priti Patel's situation was, I mean, really unusual and different from the kind of circumstances that day-to-day you would assume a cabinet minister can get into.
That's the thing. I kind of struggle to think, like, is this actually worse than, like, the fact that the foreign secretary, like, effectively endangered the life of a British citizen in Iran? That really should have been a resignation offence, right? I just don't see any way that should have been survivable in normal times. Or David Davis, like, just admitting to having lied to Parliament about whether or not he'd done his homework. This is not the kind of stuff that should be survivable, yet there they are.
Mm. But again, that's the weird thing, I think, with Amber Rudd. You know, I'm not saying she shouldn't have been sacked, but in terms of what she did, was it really worse than what Boris has done so far? I'm not sure.
And that leads us on to Boris. Disappearing Boris. Where is he? Where's he gone? What's he doing in Afghanistan? And most importantly, why was he not there to vote on Heathrow?
I mean, he was not there to vote on Heathrow because he would have either had to vote in a way he had promised not to, or he would have had to go against, defy the government whip as foreign secretary, neither of which he wanted to do.
But you know how it is when you get a call from the Afghan foreign minister who says...
Deputy
foreign minister who says, look, the only time slot I've got is this time. And he says, oh, that's the Heathrow vote.
That's embarrassing, isn't it? Yeah.
I'll jump on a plane. Don't worry, I'll be over soon, and we'll bring about that world peace that we've talked about for so long.
I do think one of the only good things that has happened in British politics in the sort of trash fire of the last 2 years since the referendum is the complete demolition of Boris Johnson's reputation and the fact that he is no longer seen as a future prime minister. That's about the only thing that's really given me any joy.
But I think that even among the conservative ranks, I think that it has been really interesting watching, so around the vote, people like Justin Greening, Greg Hands, Tom Tugendhat, very openly tweeting and taking the piss, you know, out of Boris, which I didn't think would have happened a few years ago because he was still seen as a force to be reckoned with, like him or loathe him. Whereas now it's just, you know, open season.
And we're joined now by Matt Shaddick from Ladbrokes Betting for our weekly chat about what the betting looks like around politics. Matt, we were discussing the cabinet and the opportunities that various people have had to resign and leave and that sort of thing. What does the betting show for who you think will be the next cabinet minister to leave?
Yeah, it's a pretty open market at the moment. We've had a few little scares and gambles over the last few weeks. Chris Grayling's still favourite. Obviously, there's a few things happening in the world of transport which don't reflect very well upon his department at the moment. But he may have weathered the storm after some revelations from Lisa Nandy in PMQs last week. He's 3-1 favourite. Funnily enough, second favourite is the Prime Minister herself, Theresa May, at 4-1, because there's still a pretty good chance that, I guess, that she might be replaced before anyone else is.
And you've got David Davis second favourite as well. Is that a reflection of his precarious relationship with the cabinet over Brexit?
Yeah, he's drifted out a little bit just now, actually, Joe. He's 8-1 now, because, again, he does seem to have got through that little bit of difficulty he had a week or two ago when he seemed to be threatening to quit. But at 8-1, he's still one of the more plausible runners in this market.
There's a lot of movement, as you mentioned, in this market, as people go up and down. Is it one of the fastest moving of the markets?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So another person who got back today was Greg Clark, after he seemed to be having a go at various other cabinet colleagues the other day. So he's in from 33-1 to 16-1. It's funny, actually, because back in the days when Cameron was Prime Minister, he hardly ever sacked a cabinet minister. So you could go months, I think even years, without anybody leaving the cabinet. But there's been a much higher turnover, especially since the last election. So I don't suppose we'll have too long to wait before the next one goes.
What other bets should we be looking at this week?
I don't know. I think there's been a few developments over in the USA in the last week or so to do with Trump's apparent new turn on migration, and of course then his Supreme Court victory. He's got a little bit the market's got a little bit more confident in his chances of being re-elected in 2020. He's now 6-4. Also saw a bit of money on Michael Bloomberg, 50-1 to be elected president 2020, as the usual rumors start circulating about his chances of running or not.
And that comes up quite a lot.
Yeah.
You haven't had to pay out yet, but I think we haven't had a political situation like this before, and I guess it's not inconceivable that he might run. I don't think it's completely out of the question by any means, but whether, of course, he'd win is another matter entirely.
Sure, yeah. I mean, of course, one day an independent candidate will win. I think it's 66-1 that'll happen this time around, but yeah, whether it will be this time around, I'm not so sure, but Bloomberg looks the most obvious runner from that field at the moment.
Thanks, Matt, and thanks to Ladbrokes Political Betting for sponsoring this week's episode. Boyce represents one of the constituencies around Heathrow, where obviously it is a hugely controversial... The expansion of Heathrow and the third runway is a hugely controversial subject. John, should Heathrow have a third runway?
The honest answer is I don't know. I've not read any of the many long and boring reports on the arguments for this. I do find it a bit baffling how governments keep throwing political capital at this thing when there are, like, Gatwick would love to have another runway. Like, the communities around Gatwick are quite in favour of a bigger Gatwick because there would be more jobs. It would bring kind of more money to the area. I don't quite understand why governments keep trying to expand Heathrow when there's so many people it's going to annoy. The main argument that you hear is like, oh, well, London needs what's known as a hub airport, which basically means that, you know, you can fly into London on one plane, fly out on another. You can basically get between any two destinations in the world via London. I don't really see... Like, I can see why that's great if you happen to, say, own Heathrow Airport. I can see why that's great if you're in the airline industry. What I don't really understand is why that's meant to be good for Britain or London or the people who live near Heathrow, and that's just never been properly articulated as to why a hub airport is good for anyone who doesn't own an airport.
The argument, as I understand it, and don't necessarily agree, is that it brings in more economic activity, so you have more people coming in, but it's economic activity confined to the airport, right?
Yeah, it's already like one of the, I think I'm right in saying it's the busiest international airport in the world. I think that's how. Because, like, there's an airport in Atlanta that I think has more flights, but actually most of those are within the US. So I think Heathrow is the busiest international airport in the world. But yeah, most of the loads of people will kind of pass through London. And that's that's great if you happen to be the guy running the Pret in Terminal 2 or something. But it's not clear to me why that's benefiting anyone outside it. So I don't really understand why governments keep just like wasting political capital on this when there is a much easier option 25 miles around the M25.
It's been going on now for
decades, decades.
Since before manned flight was invented. Is your sense that it now will happen, or... You still don't think it's going to kick off.
Can I just say, I feel like, you know, I'm kind of like the ghost of like airports future, airports past, but there's been a debate about opening a new airport next to my hometown in Nantes since the 1960s now. And it finally got resolved 2 months ago. So, you know, just putting out there, 50 years, we spent 50 years arguing over whether to build a new airport or not. And it was a similarly kind of like became this massive like national level political stuff. So, yeah, look forward to like many more generations of Heathrow.
And so when you say resolved, are they going to build it now?
Nope.
So it took them 50 years.
So you say it's resolved,
say no.
But I bet you at some point that proposal was going to come back. The other thing I think is worth bearing in mind about this entire debate is like Heathrow is often described as like it's the sort of national hub airport, which is why like so much political, like, so much energy goes into talking about it. But a sort of writer and campaigner who writes for City Metro, a guy called Tom Forth, who's kind of a professional Yorkshireman, did some kind of analysis and found that actually in much of the country, the hub airport you're most likely to use is actually not Heathrow, it's Amsterdam Schiphol. You will get on a plane in like Leeds, Bradford, fly to Amsterdam and then get your international flight. It's really like a sort of London and Southeast issue that's got blown up into a national issue because of our sort of London-centric view of the universe.
Which leads nicely on, actually, to...
Does it actually, though? I no longer have any faith.
Just wait. Leads on nicely to a map that Professor Mark Tudor Jones from Newcastle University published this week, showing the sphere of influence of London. So, wow, a link that actually makes sense. And this is obviously incredibly easy to describe on a podcast, but basically what it said was that London's sphere of influence extends to Cardiff and Newport and then sort of skirts around the edge of Wales all the way up past Birmingham, includes Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, and then comes down, avoids Lincolnshire, and then includes all of the southeast and southwest. If it's true, do you think it's a good thing for Britain?
Well, firstly, before I get into that, I would like to note that my own podcast, Skylines, available from all good podcast apps, used to have a Map of the Week segment, which we dropped for the precise reason that it's probably obvious to listeners now. But there is clearly a division between sort of London and London-influenced places and parts of the country that are not like that. But I think like this kind of gets mangled up with a bunch of other stuff. So like the north-south divide is huge. Like I spent a long time kind of trawling through figures and it somehow manages to be worse than I imagined it to be. I'm kind of confused. The country isn't angrier about the sort of sheer level of economic division we have in this country.
Where is the north as far as you're concerned? Where does it start?
Well, this
or
is
where
it.
Does
it
the south
quite...
start, depending on where it, you're
Milton
listening
Keynes.
From? Milton Keynes says MLC.
It doesn't really... You can't really draw a simple line. This is the problem. So we have this idea that the southeast of England is rich, and that's kind of... It's more the south-central bit, like...
London.
Essex and, but no, Essex and Kent, which border London... Are relatively poor compared
and both
to the
countries. Have areas of high social deprivation.
Yeah,
and
I mean, there's also
aren't
rich
places like Cornwall
well,
also just like Cornwall's, really, really
Cornwall's
poor,
poor
and like deprived.
Yeah, Cornwall is incredibly poor, whereas you know York is doing pretty well for itself. So it's actually quite difficult to sort of draw a line somewhere around the country and say, okay, this part is good, is doing well, and this part is doing badly. The other thing is, it does kind of get mangled up with like cultural issues, the sort of whole sort of leave versus remain thing. We have this idea that London and places influenced by it are quite remainy, whereas the real country out there is quite sort of leavy. And that doesn't really stack up either. In that, you know, Tunbridge Wells was voted remain, but Essex entirely voted leave. Or like, you know, much of the north, the cities of the north tended to vote remain, but their suburbs tended to vote leave. It just doesn't kind of map on to any of the kind of... It sort of makes sense when you look at it, but it's kind of difficult to describe in a way. You can't just say there's a line here.
But again, I find the geographical discourse around Brexit quite problematic because it's ended up being like, you know, we talk about, let's say, yeah, leave areas as if it'd been sort of like 90% for leave and remain areas that, you know, is like 90% for remain. When actually the overwhelming majority of those places also had a very sort of like, you know, tight kind of like split. It was, you know, 55-45 in not all of them, but in a lot of those places, there were still a lot of people who voted either to, you know, remain or vice versa. And it doesn't help anyone, I think, to pretend that there are bits of the country like London where everyone voted to remain and then the north where everyone voted to leave.
Yeah, I mean,
about a third of Londoners voted leave. It doesn't sort of, there is that problem where you just kind of assume that the colour on the map represents the way everyone is thinking. Like, I've been in the US during a couple of presidential election campaigns and sort of found myself semi-consciously making this assumption that, like, oh, I'm in Pennsylvania, that's a blue state, so when I meet people, they're probably going to be sort of quite sort of liberal and pro-democrat. And that's nonsense, because the reason Pennsylvania has historically been a blue state and why it turned out not to be one in 2016 is because it has enormous numbers of Democratic voters piled up around Philadelphia on one side of the state and Pittsburgh on the other. In between, it's very rural and Republican voting. And that's just kind of, but if you're used to seeing this sort of map where like half of it's blue and half of it's red, you kind of end up making these assumptions. I think we've fallen into the same problem with Brexit.
Well, I mean, in this country, an area that sort of will be regarded as overwhelmingly Remain or overwhelmingly Leave will probably have about 70% of 70% of voters. That still means a third of people in that area,
yeah,
roughly speaking, didn't go for it. And so, yeah, it's clearly more complicated. Do you think that the ideas like the Northern Powerhouse and other such
Midlands
initiatives.
Midlands Engine.
The Midlands Engine. Anyone want to make stuff up for comedy value?
No, I'm all right.
Okay. Do you think any of those have a chance of success? Will they make a difference?
I think they could if they were real things that people were actually doing. I mean, I think the idea of the Northern Powerhouse was not that crazy. Like, if you kind of look at the sort of Rhine-Ruhr region of Germany, which is a very different sort of economic history, but nonetheless, it's like it is a collection of cities bunched quite closely together that made all their money from heavy industry. It's not in that way. It's quite similar to that kind of northern belt running from like Liverpool to Hull. So it feels like we should be able to do something similar. I think the main difference between the two is like a whole load of money has gone into infrastructure in the Rhine, and like actually it's not possible to live in a suburb of Leeds and commute every day to your well-paying job in Manchester. So the idea behind the Northern Powerhouse was basically we will pump a load of money into transport and other infrastructure links to kind of make that possible. I don't think that was a crazy idea, but it has been whittled away. I've heard it said that while George Osborne was kind of serious about a lot of this stuff, he was mostly serious specifically about Manchester, and he wasn't that fussed about the rest of the region. And then he kind of got fired and decided he'd rather edit a London newspaper for a living. So the May government wasn't that fussed about the Northern Powerhouse. I mean, Osborne's motivation was in part that he kind of worked out that to get a decent majority, the Tories would need to start winning back historically marginal seats around the northern cities. The May government seems to have decided it'd be much easier to kind of go for the more immediately marginal ones in the Midlands, where they've now got a Tory mayor. So they focused all their attention there, and we started hearing about the Midlands Engine. But again, it's all these are just brand names. None of the sort of programmes of actual sort of investment that will be necessary to kind of make these more than brand names is really happening.
Can you see London's domination? I mean, obviously, it's very unlikely to end anytime soon, but can you see it even reducing anytime soon?
I guess it's plausible that it becomes self-correcting because it becomes so expensive to live in London and also like kind of boring as well. All the kind of music venues or clubs or whatever get squeezed out and replaced by posh flats, at which point young graduates are less keen to live here, at which point employers find it easier to base themselves as well. So that is plausible. It doesn't seem to have happened yet. And I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. I've kind of come to the conclusion that the single thing government could do that would actually shift anything at all would be to move the capital. Because, yeah, Maurice just made a face in a sort of, I don't want to live in the north kind of way.
I don't. But
you can get away with this because you're French, but like,
I know.
Seriously, it's like, it's really
difficult. Where would you move the capital to?
Manchester.
Right. So Manchester, not Birmingham or Milton Keynes.
No, Manchester is a real city. It's quite geographically central.
But does it need to be
central.
A real city? Could it be something like a Canberra or a Brasilia or Washington, D.C., actually, that's just created for that purpose?
But like Washington, D.C. was created for that purpose 2 centuries ago. So like the point where it's been a real city for a while now. I mean, the argument for putting it in Manchester, Jeremy Cliff, the Economist, did a rather lovely piece on this a while ago, where he basically said, apart from the economic arguments, which, you know, here is a whole sort of sector of activity you could sort of take out of London and London probably wouldn't skip a beat, but it would be a real difference to the economy of somewhere like Manchester. Cliff also argued that it would change our entire kind of, the way we kind of perceive Britain and its historic identity. Like, we don't really talk about the Industrial Revolution very much, despite the fact that was initially a British phenomenon that happened in Manchester. The way we perceive British history tends to be like royal pageantry and lists of kings and queens and so on. And that's in part, I think, because of how and where Westminster is. So like Cliff basically argued it would sort of totally change the way we organise the country. It would make it easier to kind of make the case for transport links outside London and investment outside London and. I don't think it's going to happen, so Marie can stop panicking. I don't think, even if it did happen, it would be sort of a multi-decade project. It wouldn't be something you could just press a button and do.
Like Heathrow Runway 3.
Or Brexit. You know, it's like, it's never going to happen in a million years. But I think it is part of our problem is that most countries are not as centralised. Like if you look at the US, you have like the entertainment centre and the financial centre and the political centre are all different cities. And you get similar dynamics in Germany or in Italy. In Britain, it's all kind of centralised. And England particularly, it's all centralised on this one mega city in the southeast. And so it just sucks in all the graduates. And house prices at one end of the country become unaffordable and there are no well-paying jobs in other bits of the country. It just feels like it should not be beyond the wit of man to solve that problem. And yet somehow we've been failing to solve it for 40 years.
Polling was released this week about the areas of Britain that are most anti-London in their views. Would you like to guess on the area that comes top, the most anti-London area?
I actually wrote this up, so I know the answer. Make Marie guess.
Marie, would you like to guess?
Yorkshire?
You're close. South Yorkshire was number 3. Tyne and Wear, anti-London area. Scotland.
Well, I don't like them either, so there you go.
Number 2. And the most pro-London area, number 1, Greater London. So that's really insightful.
But it was still like 30% of Londoners hate London. It's like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I remember a survey from a few years ago that said around 4 out of 10 people from London wanted to move to another area of the country. I mean, it's not the overwhelming land of milk and honey that we all clearly believe it to be.
There's another report out this week from the Resolution Foundation, which kind of like talks about this. But London basically sucks in people in your early 20s and starts spitting them out around the time they hit 30 because they get married and decide they'd like, you know, a house or a second bedroom or somewhere to keep a child. Yeah, it's like
splitters.
But this has always been the way, but it's accelerated as housing costs have become more crazy. London's always kind of pulled people in and spat them out again.
I'd like to talk now about the hot weather we've been having recently. A period of...
You're not even trying with the segues.
No, I can't.
See, you broke him down. He was very happy with his segues.
Over the last few minutes, I've actually been trying to think of one that can lead into this, and it's just not possible.
Talking about things that, you know, we have a complicated relationship with.
Talking about things that have happened in London. Mm. We've had nice weather recently.
Yeah, I can see it.
It was good. I think that works. So the strange fireball in the sky, heralding the start of autumn this weekend, has brought about all sorts of crazy behaviour. And so my question to the two of you is it acceptable for men to wear shorts in the office?
No.
What do you think?
This is a very short debate. No.
Yes.
Oh, well.
Really?
Immediately we have division.
I'm fine with that.
You're fine with that? Why do you think it's unacceptable, John?
Because it just looks dreadful. Also, there is no combination of footwear that looks good with shorts. There is no way of doing it where you don't look ridiculous. And also, Maria,
Wellington
I think you
boots?
Need to bear in mind that if you allow men to wear shorts in the office, this is also going to include men that you don't find attractive.
I know. I mean, I was going to say everyone loves to see a bit of leg. So, you know, like, thank you. You got the creep thing in me cornered there. But
that's why I sit here in my Speedos every week.
But no, I mean, I don't know. I feel like, you know, if it's really hot, it does feel unfair to make men wear trousers when women can wear floaty dresses.
Well, of course, around this time of year, we inevitably get the annual stories about my child was sent home from school because he wanted to wear shorts and it was 120 degrees in the classroom and the teachers made him wear a hoodie, a woolly hat and a jacket. What percentage of people do you think it's acceptable to wear shorts in the office? This is from polling back in 2013 during another hot period. So acceptable versus unacceptable. What do you think, Marie?
I reckon I'm in a minority. I would say 40% acceptable, 60% unacceptable.
I reckon 30% acceptable.
Well, the actual figure, 44% acceptable, 50% unacceptable. So overall, just the balance is towards unacceptable with you, John. But there's certainly
free the legs.
Yeah, exactly. There's a strong contingent there campaigning for it. I think it depends very much where you work as well. I mean, here in Delta Pole Towers, the numerous members of staff walk around here in all sorts of
the amount of skin on show at the moment is just quite distracting.
Yeah, but that's just in the studio. I mean, outside it's even more. I think top hats for me. I don't think there's ever a circumstance.
You let me sit here wearing this thing for an hour and you say that.
But, and the fact that you have that press thing stuck in the side of it makes it look really authentic. It gives it that sort of 1830s look that I really appreciate.
My hair feels hot.
It goes very well with the tails. I mean, that's the point. So you can't have one without the other. And I really do appreciate it that guests dress up. And with that, we draw things to a close. I'm afraid there was no time for our interview with Boris Johnson. Thank you very much, John, for coming along. And we leave you with some of the striking images from this week. Look at that one.
Ooh.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podotpods.com.